Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
I'm going to read this Wikipedia article on group, the mathematical idea of a group, commonly called group theory. Now, I had sort of studied it. I had used it from various times in molecular physics to label things, to look at symmetries and things like that. But it wasn't until I began restudying physics. So what's happened to me, I've had a little bit of brain trauma. I've had to pick myself up, dust myself off and get going. And so learning to podcast, learning to program, learning electronics, and again, learning mathematics, the advanced mathematics. And sort of this time, I learned at university there were courses, separate maths course, chemistry course, physics course. There was a real overlap. But coming from actually building things, I've built something which has got SU2 symmetry, which is the Einstein de Haas pendulum. Something inside it which says that symmetry is very much in nature. So the group... it means the something which exists has certain numbers available, has certain groups available to it. So when it's built with certain topology. When it actually exists, it's built by group laws, and its existence is therefore in the group world of things. So an electron has SU2 symmetry, special unitary symmetry. We'll get into the definitions of these. SU6 for fundamental particles. So as you tend to understand it, you're trying to understand it in terms of the SU6 reflects the mathematics, so the mathematics has the symmetry of it. But the symmetry is actually built into the particle itself, the actual properties of the particle itself. It's really interesting. So, with like all things... I've got to start from a very low level and build up. And one of the things is reading the Wikipedia articles. And the Wikipedia articles sometimes are poorly expressed, but in general, they go deep enough and long enough to cover every aspect of it. So, because it's written by numerous authors, it gives you... I don't know, like it's like a painting, a picture... built by a whole series of graffiti artists might be the way that you could do it. It builds something up. It has no often lacks cohesiveness, but it does represent community art, so to speak. So let's read this as we go ahead. In mathematics, a group, and that's what we're talking about, is a set of equipped with binary operations that combines two elements to form a third element in such a way that the four conditions called group axioms are satisfied, namely closure, that is, if I put the two, well, I hope you'll explain it, associative identity and invertibility. Now, I don't know what associative means. Maybe a closure that A and B will give you C, and C must be a member of the group. So what you do is you just keep on mixing the group until you run out of no new stuff formed, and there's a group done. Associative means whether A, B equals B, A. Now there's matrix operations which are not associative. And I wonder what that actually means in physical terms. The complexity coming up there. Identity means that there is an inverse and invertibility. There is an element which does nothing to a group. So that's a group. And invertibility, there is a member of the group that will produce your identity. There's a member of a group... that will produce identity, or there is an operator, a member of a group. So if you do A, B, A inverse, you'll wind up with necessarily B. One of the most familiar examples is the group set of integers together with addition operation, but groups are encountered in numerous areas within and outside mathematics, and help focusing on essential structural aspects by detaching them from concrete nature of the subject of study. So this is the sort of mathematics you do when you don't do mathematics, Clayton's mathematics. Now they've got a picture of a Rubik's Cube which shows that any orientation is a number. What? You can assign any sort of colour. So you could say position all the colours as, what is it, 9 by 4, 6. What are 9 sixes? 56 positions. So you've got 56 and 6 colours. 56 to the 6 combinations that could be in a Rubik's Cube. And some of them are, similar. You can rotate the cube around and it'll still be the same. But there's the operation that you rotate a plane, and that's a rotation. Okay, groups are fundamental kinship with the notion of symmetry. For example, a symmetric group encodes the symmetry features of a geometrical object, which is the fundamental thing. There's a symmetry of an electron, and so it has its code encoded SU2. The group consists of a set of transformations that leaves the object unchanged, and the operation of combining two such transformations by performing one after the other. Okay, so that is one specific thing. So I can, if it's symmetric, I do. If it's got mirror symmetry, and then I do that operation, it's symmetric. The interesting thing here is that if I put a mark on the mirror, I break the symmetry. So I can see that it's done, and that I can see the operation is done. But if the mark is removed, it looks the same. Like groups are a symmetry used in the standard model of particle physics. Okay, so we've got to do it. Poincaré groups, which are also Lie groups, can express the physical symmetry underlying special relativity. Point groups are used to understand the symmetry phenomena of molecular chemistry. So a point group is operations around a point. I've been eaten by mosquitoes again here. The concept of group arose from the study of polynomial equations, starting with Evariste Galois in 1830, who introduced the term a group or groupe in French for a symmetry group of the roots of an equation, now called a Galois group. So, what does that mean? That's pretty amazing. So, he's saying this. Let's read this. Polynomial equations, whatever that is. After contributions from other fields such as number theory and geometry, the group notation was generalized and was firmly established around 1870. Modern group theory, an active mathematical discipline, studies groups in their own right. To explore groups, mathematicians have devised various notations to break groups into smaller, better understandable pieces, such as subgroup or quotient groups or simple groups. In addition to their abstract properties, group theorists also study different ways in which a group can be expressed concretely, both from the point of view of representation theory, that is, through representations of a group, and of computational group theory, whatever that is. So this is really interesting because a particle represents a group. So there you go. Now I wonder what computational group theory is. A theory has been developed for finite groups, which culminated in the classification of finite simple groups, complete in 2004. Since the mid-80s, geometric group theory, which studies finite generated groups as geometric objects, has become an active area of group theory. So, finitely generated groups as geometric objects. Wow, that's just, it's intense. I know that you might find this over the head. So, a group is basically a way of talking about the properties of an operator. You know, I think you have to have an operator. An operator must generate members of a group. Then you can build a model, and then the thing is that we have these things sitting around, and we say, "Well, that's a model of a group," and it's sort of it tells you about the underlying symmetry. As I say, in the case of electrons, it tells you about the spin, the rotation, angular momentum of the universe. First example, here's a good few things. The integers. One of the most familiar groups is Z. So this is, I don't know how you describe this Z with that little double line. I don't know how you describe it. It's Z with two lines in it. And this is Z, R, R, and C. So Z is integers, minus 4, minus 3, minus 2, 1, 0, sorry, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, together with addition. So this is what I think you need, the group and addition there. So it's you need a group and a group operator. The following property of integers and additions serves to model as the group axiom's definition. Any two integers, the sum of also an integer. For all integers A, B, and C, A plus B plus C equals C, B plus C, expressed in words, but adding A and B first, so it's known as associative, so it actually doesn't matter. But there's associative, and I may have said that incorrectly before. And I've forgotten, there's my brain going, I cannot remember the name for commutate, something like that. If any integer plus zero, then zero is the identity. For every integer A, there is an integer B, such that A plus B equals B plus A equals zero. It's the inverse element. Okay, definition. So that's first example, definition. A group is a set G together with an operation called a group law of G. See, isn't that amazing that you've got G and a group law that combines the two elements A and B with another element, denoted A, B, or A dot B, or AB. To qualify as a group, the set operations G dot must satisfy the known group axioms. So what does the dot mean? Here, the group axioms for a group are short and natural, yet somehow hidden behind the axioms is the monster simple group, a huge, extraordinarily mathematical object which appears to rely on numerous bizarre coincidences to exist. The axioms of the group give no obvious hint that anything like this exists. Well, I don't know what that really means. So, closure. For all A and B in G, the result of the operation A dot B is also in G. Associativity, for all A, B, and C, you can do A and B or B, C next, the identity element. There exists an E, normally called I, but okay, E. E dot A equals A dot E equals A holds. Such an element is unique below, and thus one speaks of the identity element. Okay, so can you have two elements? So that's why it's identity. There's only one. The inverse element. For every A in G, there's an A to the minus one. The result of a group operation may depend. Now, what is an Albion? I wonder what an Albion group is. Hopefully, they'll explain it. The result of a group operation may depend on the order of the operands. In other words, combining an element A and B is not B and A. So, A dot B equals B dot A is not always true for every two elements. The equation that always holds in group integers under addition is a plus b equals b plus a. For any two integers, it's commutativity of addition. Groups for which commutativity equation a dot b equals b dot a always holds are called Alabian groups. There you go. I can sort of remember that. So commutative groups are just simple groups where you can, the order doesn't matter. Another Niels Hendrik Abel. The symmetry Alabian, Abelian. The symmetry group described in the following section is an example of a group which is not Alabian. So that's always origami. The identity group of G is often written as 1 or 1 sub GD, a notation inherited from the multiplicative identity. This group, if the group is Alabian, then one may choose to denote the group operation by plus or the identity element by 0. In that case, the group is called an additive group. The identity element can also be written as ID. Okay, so that's what the D is. ID. I've sort of got some notes sent from me from Rochester, New York. I've got to think of some. Rutgers University in New York sent me some notes, and there was ID. I didn't understand what that was. Identity. Okay. The set G is called the underlying set of the group G dot. So dot is the operation. Oh, so dot is the operation. That's what G dot means. G dot. You can have a G plus, but G dot is the operation. Often the group's G is used the short name for G dot. That's interesting. So when I talk SU2, I really am saying SU2 in brackets dot. Along the same lines, the shorthand expression for a subset of the group G, an element of the group G, is used. What is actually meant? A subset of the underlying set G of the group G dot. An element of the underlying G. Or an element of the underlying set G in the group G dot. Usually it's clear from the context whether the symbol like G refers to a group or the underlying set. Okay, so G is a grab bag of numbers, so I can have all the integers, negative, zero, and positive integers, and plus, and that's what I, so it's, because it's, there's the operator and the group go together, you don't have to get them separately. An alternative but equivalent definition is to expand the structure of a group to define a group as a set equipped with three operations satisfying the same axioms above. Whatever that is, the, so there are three operations you could do. You could do produce another group member, you could identity, and or you can do an inverse, but let's see. An alternative but equivalent definition is expand the structure of a group to define a group as a set equipped with three operations satisfying the same axioms as above, with and there exists a part removed in at least two axioms, these operations being group law as above, which is binary operation, inverse operation, unitary operation. That doesn't make sense. So add two, surely an inverse is a binary operation, and unitary operations. So I suppose B inverse B must equal inverse B B. Because it equals 1, so I think an inverse operation is a special one. And maps A to A to the negative 1, the identity element, is viewed as an O-Ary operation, rather than a binary operation, an O-Ary operation. This formulation of definition avoids extensive qualifiers. It's generally preferred for computing groups with the computer-aided proofs. This formulation exhibits groups as a variety of universal algebra. It's also so useful in talking of properties of the inverse operation as needed for defining topological groups and group objects. I know this is going to be really hard to listen to as a podcast, but I sort of understand it here. So you can have a group, and you can have the operations, or you can say you can break that operation into three styles of operation. An operation which is a unitary operation, an inverse operation, or a competitive operation. For example, a symmetry group. Two figures in a plane are congruent if one can be changed into the other using a combination of rotation, reflection, translations. Any figure is congruent to itself. However, some figures are congruent to themselves in more than one way. And extra congruences are called symmetries. A square has 8 symmetries. So you can reflect and rotate it. A circle's got infinite ones, doesn't it? Okay. So you can do these things. So here's the 8 symmetries. ID, which is keeping it as it is. Rotation by 90 degrees clockwise. A vertical reflection, horizontal reflection, diagonal reflection, counter-diagonal reflection. The identity operation, leaving everything unchanged, is known as ID. Rotation of the square around 90 degrees, clockwise, anti-clockwise, etc. That's R1, 2, 3. Reflection about horizontal is FH and FV, and diagonal FD and FC, a fold, I suppose. So it's F and R's. So we've got three rotations. Okay, so a anti-clockwise R3 is R1, so to speak, because it's rotating at 90 degrees is equivalent to counter-rotating it opposite of that. These symmetries are represented by functions. Each of these functions sends a point on the square to a corresponding point under the symmetry. For example, R1 sends a point to 90 degrees clockwise around the square centre. FH sends a point to reflection across the square's vertical middle. Composing two symmetry functions gives another symmetry function. These symmetries determine a group called the dihedral group of the square degree 4, D4. The underlying set of groups is above the set symmetry function of a group. So there I've got... Do I have three functions? So they're members of the group. So there's really 8 shiwis. That's a bit complex to do, but there's group members. Now this appears to be several operations that I can do. But the points are the actual operations are members of the group, and the operators just apply one and the other. So I sort of get that one. Let's let me read it. The result of performing the first operation in the B is represented symbolically from right to left. Apply symmetry B after performing symmetry A. Oh, wow. So, B dot A means... So, if I've got an object, and I say B dot A, I mean, you do A and then B. So it's, you read from right to left. Oh, wow, you read it backwards. Oh, I didn't know that in group symmetry. So you're reading a set of group operators. You start the one closest to it. And so that sort of makes sense. If I want to add another operator, I add it to the outside. The group table on the right is a list of results of such compositions possible. For example, rotating 270 degrees clockwise and then reflecting horizontally, FH is the same as performing the reflection along the diagonal. Wow. So do this one. You rotate 3, so it's FH dot R3 equals FD, which actually means R3 dot FH. Now, given this set of symmetries described operation, the group axioms are understood as follows. The closure axiom demands that the composition of A and B, any two symmetries, is also a symmetry. For example, we've got FH R3, which is the opposite, is FC. Rotating 720 degrees clockwise after reflecting horizontally, equals reflecting along the counter diagonal, FC. Indeed, every other combination of two symmetries still gives a symmetry, as can be checked using the group table. So, you've got different things, and then I don't quite think. Associativity means constraints. Deals with composing two or more symmetries, starting with three symmetry elements, A, C, B, C, of D4. There are two possible ways of using these three symmetries in order to determine a symmetry of a square. One of these ways is to first compose A and B to a single symmetry, then compose that similar symmetry C. So you can do, so it says that I can do A, B, so if I do C, B, A, if I do C, or if I consider doing B and A, so I can, so what it says is A dot B in brackets dot C equals A dot in brackets B dot C. So associative means that I can go ahead. This means that two ways are the same. A product of many group elements can be simplified in any group. For example, F dot V dot R2 equals FD dot FV dot R2. This can be checked using the group table on the right. So that's true. So associative means that if I've got a string of operations, I can collapse them. Consider them, work them out in little groups. I sort of understand that. So associative means that if I'm doing a series of operations, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I can do, if I consider doing, compressing 6 and 7, if I do 6, 7, I work out what that means. I can drop it down, I can do anything. I can sort of understand that. So if I'm doing, say, 5 operations, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I can consider that as compressing it as 1, 2, and 3 and 4. I can do work out what 3 and 4 is and do that as another operation. It might be another thing. Or I can do 1 and then do 2 and 3 together first. The entity element is leaving everything unchanged for symmetry A is performing ID is symbolic form ID dot A equals A and A dot ID equals A. So it doesn't matter the if I do a symmetry one, it's okay. And that, I've just got to go back and check what an Albion group is. Gee whiz, actually, it's my brain giving out. Albion group, I think, is a commutative. Yeah, commutative. Albion group, it doesn't matter which way you do it. I'm just going to double-check that. Oh, yeah. So an Albion group, it doesn't matter, but this is a non-Albion group. it does matter. So albium means it matters. It doesn't. It does matter the order you do things in. Now that's interesting, because then to have time symmetry, it's, you know, going forward and backward in time. I was trying to think, Faraday, there is a object which is a Faraday mirror, which changes the sense of polarization depending on the way that you go through the crystal. So that's an interesting thing, a Faraday rotator. That's a non-albion group. So an albion group is commutative group. Okay, now four. The inverse element undoes the transformation for some other element. Every symmetry can be undone. Each of the following transformation, identity, ID, and reflections. So FH and FV, FD, FC, and the 180-degree rotation has its own inverse. Okay, so FH, if I do FH and I do 180 and 180, it gets back. Or if I flip it over, reflect it on a symmetry, it's back. Because performing twice brings it back to the original orientation. Rotations R3 and R1 are each other's inverses because we're rotating 90 degrees, and then another 270 or vice versa yields 360. So FH equals ID. R3.R1 equals R1.R3 equals ID. And so in that case, they are what is it? Three groups. Now there's three, I'm trying to remember, there are three classes of operators. There's the identity operator, there's the inverse operator, and then there's the other operators which aren't identity or inverse. In contrast, a group of integers above, where the order of operation is irrelevant, it does matter. In D4, the D4 of FH dot R1 equals FC, but R1 dot FH equals FD. In other words, D4 is not albium, which makes the group structure more difficult than the integers introduced first. There you go. I'm following this. I don't know if you can, but I'm getting it. So a group, let's go in. A group is a set of numbers and an operator, and it has four features with it. What are those four features? Good God. It's got to have an identity, an inverse, associative. Got to have an identity, something which doesn't, an inverse, which redoes it. Associative, it doesn't matter what order you do it, and there's another term there besides associative. And I'll just see what the other term was. Closure. So it's got to be, it's got to always generate. It can't matter if you've got a list, how you pick it off, you combine it. The order of the list matters, but how you actually work through that list doesn't matter. Okay, now we're on to question page 4 of 13 through here. History. This is easier, less brain strain to read the history. The modern concept of abstract groups developed out of several fields of mathematics. The original motivation of group theory was the quest for the solution of polynomial equations of a degree higher than 4. So that's x to the 5th. The 19th century French mathematician F.R. Scalois, historian prior work of Paolo Ruffini and Joseph-Louis Lagrange, gave a criteria for solubility of a particular polynomial equation in terms of the symmetry group of its root solution. The elements, such as the Galois group, correspond to certain permutations of roots. The first Galois idea were rejected by his contemporaries and published only posthumously. More general permutation groups were investigated, in particular Augustine, Louis Cauchy, and Carles, on the theory of groups as depending on the symbolic equation theta to the end equals 1. So, and if you give us the first absolute definition of a finite group. So a addition is an infinite group. A finite group has some way of, as you're going through, your inverse is ahead somehow in it. I'm just really trying to think, and so this is, I suppose, interesting for me in that posthumously, you know, like I'm having a pretty crap time coming up with mathematical theorems and mathematical ideas, and they're rejected, and perhaps when I'm dead, gone dead, it'll be rediscovered. Geometry is the second field in which groups were used systematically, especially symmetry groups, as part of Felix Klein's 1872 Engen-Programm, after novel geometries such as hyperbolic and projective geometry had emerged. Klein used group theory to organise them into a more coherent way. Further advancing these ideas, Sophius Lie founded the study of Lie groups in 1884. So the question I just really, you got your objects, and it's the symmetry of the objects that's really get here. You've got Klein bottom. Your topologies here. A third field contributing to group theory was number theory. Certain Albion group structures had been used implicitly by Carl Friedrich Gauss. Number theoretical work, Dischner's Arithmetic in 1798, more explicit by Leopold Kronecker Delta. In 1847, Ernst Krummer made the early attempts to prove Fermat's last theorem by developing groups describing factorization into prime numbers. Well, that's pretty amazing. The convergence of these various sources into a uniform theory of groups was started by Camille Jordan's Traite des substitutions et les équations algébriques in 1870. Walter von Dyck introduced the idea of specifying a group by means of generators and relations. So, group. Yeah, it's pretty interesting that if I have a single set of numbers associated. I just wonder, then you have a subgroup, a subgroup will produce a region within a group, which is pretty interesting. Now, convergence, as in the 20th century, groups gained wide recognition by the pioneering work of Friedrich von Fromius and William Burnside, who worked on the representation theory of finite groups, Richard Brauer, modular representation theory, and Arthur Schur's paper. The theory of Lie groups, and more generally locally compact groups, was studied by Hermann Weyl and Elie Cartan and many others. His algebraic counterpart, the theory of algebraic groups, was first shaped by Claude Chevalley, from the late 1930s, and later work of Alan Borel and Jacques Tietz. Look, there's someone called Jacques Tietz, T-I-T-S. Now, what's interesting is it's such a fundamental, broad idea, but for me it's sort of very interesting in that we're living in a very symmetric universe, aren't we? The University of Chicago, 1960-61 group theory year, brought together group theorists such as Daniel Goldstone, John J. Thompson, Walter Fiat, laying the foundations for a collaboration that The input of numerous other mathematicians led to the classification of finite simple groups, with the final step taken by Aschbacher and Smith in 2004. This project exceeded previous mathematical endeavors by its sheer size in both length and proof and number of researchers. The research is ongoing to simplify the proof of its classification. These days, group theory is still a highly active mathematical branch impacting many other fields. So, that's what the heck is going on here. Elementary consequences of group axioms. The basic fact that all groups can be obtained directly from group axioms are commonly assumed under the elementary group theory. For example, repeated application of associative axioms shows that unambiguity that A dot B dot C equals A dot B in brackets dot C equals A dot in brackets B dot C generalizes to more than three factors, because it implies that the parentheses can be inserted anywhere in such a series of terms. Parentheses are usually omitted. Okay, because that's interesting, because it doesn't matter how you're constructing something, you can do any set of two procedures next to each other and all get done. It's unlike building an IKEA table. You can't, I suppose, it's like you could say, if it said unpack, it's not like a sequential group of things. It's not building IKEA tables, not a group. Uniqueness of the identity and element inverses. Two important consequences of group axioms are the uniqueness of the identity element and the uniqueness of the inverse element. There can only be one identity element of a group. I can well imagine that. And each element of the group has exactly one inverse element. Thus, it is customary to speak of the identity element and the inverse of an element. To prove the uniqueness of an inverse element, I propose A has two inverses. I can well imagine. Denoted B and C of group G with an operator dot, then B equals B dot E, and B dot A dot C equals B dot A dot C, because A dot C is inverse. Then associative, you do B dot A, and B dot A has to be E, so B equals C, so B and C have to be the same. I can sort of see that one. So going through that, if you have two inverses, the two inverses have to be the same due to associativity. I can see that one. The term B in the first line above C are equal, since they are connected by a chain of equalities. In other words, there is only one inverse. Similarly, to prove that the identity element the group is unique, assume G is a group with two identity elements and therefore they're the same. So if I do E dot F, let's see how they do it. I'm going to sneeze. Oh, good on you, COVID. Oh, I hope you don't catch cold down the internet. Divisions. In groups, the existence of an inverse element implies that division is possible. Given elements A and B and a group, there is exactly one solution, X and G, to the equation X to A equals B. Sorry. Namely, B dot A inverse. Let's try and work this one out. Exactly one solution, X and G, to the equation X dot A equals B. Namely, B dot A inverse. Yeah, I could see that. So, if it's B dot A inverse dot A equals B, A dot B is E, so that's really interesting. So for any element, for any transformation, you can rewrite any transformation by the answer with the inverse of the operation that you want to do. So if I want to get to a particular symmetry, I go back to one and then just do that one step. So if I want to do convert a rotation to the right to a fold, a counterfold, I just do inverse rotation to the right and then just the counterfold. You know, that's fairly simple. Unique results by multiplying two equations side by A to the minus 1. The element B to the A minus 1 is denoted as B slash A is called the right quotient of B by A, the result of division of B by A. I can sort of see that. Similarly, there is exactly one solution, Y and G, with the equation Y dot A dot Y equals B, namely A to the minus 1. Dot B, yeah, is the left quotient. Sometimes, oh, so you've got a forward slash and backslash. So let's do, if you do a forward slash, it means B dot A to the minus 1. Forward slash, it means the minus 1's there. If it's backslash, So if you've got a forward and backslash in group theory, the direction that your forwards, the forward or backslash is pointing is where the minus 1 goes, a left and right quotient. I can get that one up there. Okay, question. So I've got getting this through so far, grinding through this group theory. And really interesting about SO in brackets 2, SU1, 1, and SU2, whatever that means. So, I wonder what an S special. We'll go through this. In general, B dash A and B, and so B forward slash A and A forward slash B may be different. So, but if the group operation is commutative, that is, the group is Albion, they're equal, obviously. So, B forward slash A means that the A is to the minus 1, and A backslash B means A to the minus 1. So that's okay. In this case, the group operation is denoted as addition. In other words, it takes subtraction and difference instead of division and quotient. Okay, so I can sort of see that. So they say, in this case, the group operation is often denoted. So so we can see what's going on. I can sort of see that multiplications like reflection and additions like adding. So if it's, you use plus and minus if it's commutative, and multiplication and division if it's non-commutative. And non-commutative means that AB does not equal BA. A consequence of this is that multiplication of a group element G is called bijection, not reflection, bijection. Specifically, if G is an element of the group G, then the function from G to itself maps H is an element of G to G dot H is a bijection. This function is called the left translation of G. Similarly, the right translation of G is a bijection of G to itself, which maps H to H dot G. If G is Albion, the left and right translation of the group are the same. So I'll just try and work this one out. So let me reread that one. A consequence of this is that the multiplication of a group element is bijection. That's if it's an Albion. Okay, so an Albion. Specifically, if G is an element of a group, the function from G to itself that maps H to an element of G to G dot H is a bijection. This function is called the left translation of G. Similarly, the right translation of G, bijection to itself, is H to H dot G, so the opposite. Okay, I can sort of get that. That's a bit much for my brain to pick up at this point in time. So there's something called bijection and for multiplication. Basic concepts. To understand a group beyond the level of mere symbolic manipulations above, more structural concepts are employed. There is conceptual principles underlying all the following notations. To take advantage of the structure offered by groups, which sets being structureless do not have. Okay, so if I have just a group of shopping, it doesn't matter, but if I have a group of group which has got this operation, so this difference between a structured group. So, constructions related to groups have to be compatible with group operation. This compatibility manifests itself in the following notations in various ways. For example, groups can be related to each other via functions called group homomorphisms. By the mentioned principle, they are required to respect group structures in a precise sense. The structure of groups can be understood by breaking them down into pieces called subgroups and quotient groups. The principle of preserving structures are recurring topics in mathematical throughout. It's an instance of working in a category. In these cases, category of groups. So I can have a subgroup of, say, even numbers. Right, and odd numbers are two subgroups. Addition of an even numbers will always leave an even number. Addition of an odd number will always leave an odd number. Now, that is complicated. An identity group. An I is an identity of both those groups, or zero is an identity of both those groups. So, 1 minus 1 is the thing. 1 minus 1 is 0. 1 plus 3 is... Oh, shit. It doesn't quite work, does it? It must be... Multiplication would be an example. So, 2... Oh, shit. That's 2 odd numbers. 3 times 3... is 9. Yeah, odd numbers multiply by each. Oh, except that's got an inverse of a third. I'll have to work this out in my head. Okay. Group homomorphisms. So, it's the same shape. A group homomorphism are functions that preserve a group structure. So, a function A applied to all group members maps G to H. Between two groups, G dot and H star is called a homomorphism equation. So, this is interesting because all wave function solutions correspond to your Hilbert space of groups. So, you can have an unbound group of wave function solutions, and that gives you an infinite variety of potentials that you generate it with. So, so if I've got G, and it produces a group H, if I've got an operator G, it produces H, and a group H operated by star is called a homomorphism if the equation A G dot K equals A dot G star dot K. So I don't know what A is there. If I have an operation on G dot K, so A takes G into H. So if I put two elements together and then transfer it into the next group, I can sort of see it like that. So A takes all elements of G and maps it onto group H. If I have two elements in my first group G, small g and k, that's so stupid. I have a group and it has elements g and k in it, group g, and g dot k, let's call it a dot c, a dot b generates c. I can do my operation on c, or I can do my operation on A dot C and then do that same intergroup operation there. So it means that your group has different labels on it, but the operations are the same. So the groups are... the groups are identical. The groups are identical, but they've got different names on it. They've got the same structure and the same different names. So let's do this one again. I've got a group, A dot B equals C. If I do an operator on it, which unfortunately let's call the operator F. F onto A dot B equals F into A star F into B, where star is the homomorphic operation with it. In other words, the result is the same performing group operation before or after applying the operation map A. Okay. This ensures that the identity of A into G is the operation, that identity. So you can well imagine that the identity maps across, and it also maps. It means that the inverses maps. So they're all the same, except the names of everything have changed. So I wonder how that goes for rotation of groups. Thus, a group homomorphism respects the structure of G provided by the group axioms. True groups G and H are called isomorphic if there exists a homomorphism at G to H and B H to G, such that applying the two functions one after another to each of the two possible orders gives identity functions, gives the identity function of G and H. That is, if I map H into B, and then that mapped HB back into A, it gives me back H. From our point of view, the isomorphic group carries the same information. For example, G dot G equals G1. Okay, well, that... I don't quite understand that one there. So, group homomorphism. So, a group... I can map things into a group, and it's homomorphic. I don't know what the difference between how you could have a homomorphic group, which isn't isomorphic. Subgroups. Informally, a subgroup of H is contained... a subgroup is a group H contained within a big group G. Concretely, identity elements G contain H. So The identity element has to be in any subgroup, because a subgroup has to have an identity element. Concrete, the identity element of G contained in H, when the H, H2 are an H, and so H dash H minus 1, so they have to be, because it's got to have the identity element in it, it has to be able to be M. Let's read it again. So the elements of H equipped with the group operation of G are restricted to H, indeed form a group. So I could have a series of operations which never go into the quotient group. In the example above, the identity of rotations constitute a subgroup. So I can rotate, highlighted in red in the group table above, any two rotations are still composed of a rotation that can be undone. Complementary, 270 and 90, 180 and 180, 90 or 270. The subgroup test is necessary and sufficient condition for a non-empty set H of a group to be a subgroup is sufficient to check that G H is an element of H for all elements of G and H. Knowing the subgroup is an important understanding of group as a whole. So, oh my god, this is going to... Bloody hell, these mosquitoes around me, full gorged with my blood. Hope I don't suffer a Ross River fever. You can get a few fevers, rare fevers, not up in the mountains, but on the other side of the Blue Mountains, you can pick up bad fevers. Now, cosets. So I can understand homomorphic groups, the same group but by a different name, sort of like French and English. And the subgroups are sort of like a subgroup would be like your people speaking down the pub. They don't know any advanced maths, so they can talk about things, but they only ever talk about things like that. It's interesting, the social idea of groups. Cosets. In many situations, it's desirable to consider two group elements the same if they differ by an element of a given subgroup. For example, D4 above, once the reflection is performed, the square never gets back the R2 configuration just by applying rotation operations and no further reflections, i.e. the rotation operation are irrelevant to the question of whether the reflection was performed. The cosets used to formulate the insight. Subgroup H defines left and right cosets, which can be thought as translations of H in arbitrary group elements of G. Symbolic terms of left and right cosets of H of G are containing... I can get a series of elements. So this is not operation. These are not operators, but these are configurations I can get. Once it's been reflected, you can do several rotations, but you can never get back. You can never get back to it. So I'm just trying to think whether that's... So you've got your group of... reflections and operators, but the things you can do. But you've also got your group of so a set of a group is the result from it. So let's just try and work this out. Cosets are used to formalize the insight. A subgroup H defines a left and right cosets, which can be thought of as a translation of H by an arbitrary group set element G. If symbolic terms left and right cosets of H contain GR, so G.H and H.G respectively, the left coset of any subgroup form a partition of G, that is, the union of all left cosets is equal to G, and two left cosets are either equal or have an empty intersection. The first case, G.H equals G2.H1, happens precisely when G to the minus 1 dot G is an element of H. If the two elements differ by an element of H, similarly consideration applies to the right coset. Left and right cosets of H may or may not be equal. If they are, all G in G, G dot H equals H dot G, then H is said to be a normal subgroup. Okay, so that's, I've got that, but it hasn't really sunk in what exactly that means. I'll probably have to reread that several times to get that, or do a few examples. So you can have left and right groups, subgroups, by, so a subgroup is a series of operations which go in each other, but you can actually push yourself up into it. You can describe a subgroup with an operator before and after. A quotient group, now that's pretty easy to do. In some situations, a set of cosets of a subgroup can be endowed with a group law, giving it a quotient group or a factor group. This is possible for the subgroup to be a normal. So, let's go back to what it's said here. Oh, so it's a normal subgroup. Okay, now I've just skipped a bit. So normal subgroup, going back to it, says that you can do an operation G to the subgroup, any member of the subgroup, or the subgroup afterwards. You can say do a reflection to the rotation subgroup, and that will get you another set of things. So H is a subgroup, and H plus reflection is a subgroup, or H a reflection plus a subgroup, or a subgroup plus a reflection. If they are both the same, it doesn't matter. It's not that each element is mapped in the same way, but each element's mapped to the same subgroup. So I can sort of see that. In D4, the introduction of symmetry group, the left coset G dot R of the subgroup consisting of the rotations are either equal to R, if G is an element of R itself, or otherwise equal to U. So I don't know what U is. U equals FC dot R. So this is a counterfold R equals the set of FC, FV, FD, FH, highlighted in green. Subgroups are also normal because F dot CR equals U equals F dot CR. So U is a group of other elements. There you go. Similarly, for any element other than FC, in fact, in the case of D4, observe that all such cosets are equal, such that FHR equals FVR equals FDR equals FCR. So it's the coset. So you've got a subgroup, and you can have a group mapped out of your subgroup, a quotient group. In some situations, the set of cosets of a subgroup can be endowed with a group law, giving a quotient group or factor group. Okay, so I have now got a new group of FR, FV, I can go through there, or factor group. For this, it is possible to the subgroup to be normal, given the normal subgroup and the quotient group is defined by G slash N is GN is an element of G, or G modulo is called G modulo N. Wow, that's, unfortunately, guys, that's going a little, that can't be the end of it. That's 4. That's page 5 there, and page 5, stop printing after page 5. Well, I'm going to limit it at the moment now, because I have been reading for an hour and 40 minutes, an hour and 10 minutes reading this. I'll go through and work a bit further on it. I suggest you print out the, as I have done, the Wikipedia article and just smash your way through it. Four. I've got a few more pages to read on this. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.